everyone. Welcome to the 412th Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and your co-host,
Kevin Toefel.
And we have a lot to talk about this week, especially with regards to, holy moly, the CHIPS Act, all of that, and Mobile World Congress, which is finally happening this week in Barcelona. And we're also going to be talking about cybersecurity in the home, new chips, actually lots of new chips related to Mobile World Congress, but even some other new chips, this one with NFC, wireless power. ADT has reported their earnings, and there's some fun little tidbits related to its deal with Google. And the Google Pixel Watch has some updates, and I might complain a little bit about my Fitbit. We're also going to hear from our sponsor, Influx Data, and our guest this week is Paulus Schautzen, who is co-founder of Home Assistant. He is on the show to give us some updates on Home Assistant, its year of voice, what the heck it's doing with Matter, and Home Assistant's plans for new hardware. All of this and more awaits you. But first, let's hear from our sponsor. This week's sponsor is Silicon Labs, a leader in secure, intelligent wireless technology. And they want to let you know that they have launched their 2023 Tech Talks schedule. This year's Tech Talks include dedicated technology series for Matter, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, and LPWANs to help you build the development skills needed to deliver cutting-edge IoT products. You can join Silicon Labs experts and industry leaders for these one-hour virtual trainings created for developers and by developers. Tune in, ask questions, and accelerate your device development today. You can register now at scilabs.com. And I'll just let you know, I actually did one of the ML and predictive maintenance and safety applications ones. It was using Bluetooth. This was last week's, and it was pretty awesome. If you register, you actually get a chance to watch it on demand later as well. So, moving on to the show. Okay, let's talk chips, specifically the CHIPS Act, which was a $53 billion, I don't want to say boondoggle, because we don't know if it's going to be a boondoggle, but it's a government grant program to bring chip and semiconductor manufacturing back to the U.S. because it has meandered off. Basically, every high-end chip, not every, 90-something percent of high-end chips that are in our devices are made at TSMC.
Yeah, Samsung as well.
Well, Samsung does have a manufacturing facility in Austin. So, okay, I'm an old chip reporter, and I actually used to cover chips, and I started out in Austin. And the reason Austin had such a big chip industry is because way back in the 80s, the U.S. government created an organization called Semitech. And this was a government-funded and industry-funded consortium that was designed to advance semiconductor manufacturing techniques. And they put it in Austin, and then, I don't know, decades later, it moved to like Albany, New York. But it was the reason like all these companies, there was Motorola. I know Motorola doesn't make chips anymore, but
no.
It used to, and then it became Freescale, and then Freescale got bought by NXP. Anyway, there's a whole history. And the reason why Austin had such a big business was because of Semitech. And it was because of a government-run program from back in the, I think it was the late 80s. So these sorts of programs are really important, is the bottom line. And today, even Austin has, Samsung has invested billions in high-end 300-millimeter wafer fabs there for their Exynos and memory chips. And there are still, there are actually still chip plants there today. GlobalFoundries, I believe, has something. So yeah, that's kind of a little, I was going to say it's a non sequitur, but it's totally a sequitur.
Well, no, it's good background because like this is the kind of thing that will spur the production and R&D here, which is what they're trying to accomplish. And it's worked in the past, although I didn't follow it back then. I don't know if they had the constraints that are being put into the current CHIPS Act.
They announced the plan on Tuesday. This is for not the full $53 billion. This is for $39 billion that are opening up to manufacturers through the U.S. CHIPS Act. And if you are a chip company that gets subsidies, there's some really weird details, such as you're going to have to share some of your profits, that excess profits is what they're calling it, with the U.S. government. That basically means you, when you apply for this, you are going to say, hey, this is how much I think I'm going to get from this investment. And over that, this is very simplistic, but you'll have to share. You also will have to provide affordable childcare for employees. And these rules are going to apply to companies that receive $150 million or more in direct funding from this federal fund. So this is, I mean, and $150 million is nothing when it comes to building a chip manufacturing plant. I need y'all to know that these plants can cost billions, like plural. And that is because some of the shell itself is maybe not as expensive, but you've got to have clean rooms. Those are very expensive to build. You also have to have guaranteed water supply in areas where you don't have water restrictions are happening. Arizona is a popular place for chip plants, which makes no sense because they do need a lot of fresh water to keep things clean. You're going to have a very complex filtration, water filtration system. And then in addition to all
good coffee machines too.
And good coffee machines, right.
Yeah.
Those bunny suited workers hop in. But you also have to buy the equipment and the like lithography equipment, the etching equipment, all of this stuff, so expensive. Like you can spend millions on just the individual masks for the lithography. So not even the actual lithography equipment, which is hundreds of millions of dollars. But I mean, it's a lot of money. So $150 million is like nothing. I need y'all to know that.
So the childcare thing will apply very likely to most of the companies who take advantage of this.
Yes. And then the final thing is chip makers, they have to agree not to expand their manufacturing capacity in China for 10 years if they want to get funding, which is really great.
Yeah. It's all trying to serve a specific purpose. I mean, it may seem like an overreach, but I get it. I mean, at least it's clearly defined. So I get it.
I do. There's also some things to think about here. The U.S. government is worried because they're like, hey, we use chips in everything. All of our military equipment, all of our appliances, cars, any of our networking, like telecom networking equipment uses chips. And in some areas, especially like telecom, those chips are getting much more advanced, right? When we're talking about 5G and upcoming 6G networks, we're talking about chips that are actually like directing the flow of antennas based on interpretation of the quality of data transfer. So it's if you imagine something sensing the quality of, did this data message make it all the way? What's in the way? Let me adjust my antenna. It's a lot of I was going to say proprioception. That's how we would do it. But it's basically now
it's physics.
Yeah. The chips are having to move antennas around to gather the optimal wireless. And I feel like I'm just babbling. I'm going to stop.
No. It makes sense.
It's hard.
And the other part. Yeah.
It's chips.
This is just like maths. Yep. Chips are hard. The other thing is, I mean, with such reliance on connected and smart devices throughout, the risk of having unknown backdoors put into chips that are made overseas, you've got to eliminate that or at least reduce the risk of that. So that's another big piece of the puzzle, I think.
Yes. And I actually am in favor of this because y'all probably are aware that I'm pretty liberal. But the Commerce Department said that you can't use your CHIPS Act grants for stock buybacks or dividends. And you have to tell people about your plans for stock buybacks over 5 years. So basically, they're like, look, we don't want to give you taxpayer dollars and just have you funnel that over to investors, which I'm okay with.
I'm okay with that. I mean, there were probably fewer conditions on the 2008 automobile bailout funding from the government, which was also taxpayer money here in the U.S. All these extra things being put in here is A, because it is taxpayer money, but B, because the social programs that they're kind of inserting here, say with childcare, for example, or eliminating buybacks through this particular thing, is because they can't get it passed any other way. So I get it, and I know people don't like it, but if you're in favor of those things, and I'll say up front, I am, then that's one way to make it can happen.
I think it's awful because we did it with employer-tied healthcare.
Right.
And I mean, and that was not 100 years ago, but it was a long time ago, decades ago.
It was in the 80s, I think.
No.
Before that?
But this went all the way back to the 40s. And what happened is the IRS said, if you're going to give people health insurance, employer-based health insurance should be tax exempt. So then it became really cheap to get your job through health insurance or through your employer.
Makes sense. And then that's created highly contributed to the healthcare challenges we face today here. And you don't want to see that happen with childcare, nor do I, but
No, I don't. I mean, I get that this is overall trying to be good, and that's government programs for you. You'll get a little bit of good, a little bit of bad, a little bit of what the heck? Okay, so what does this mean for the IoT, which is probably why y'all are listening to this show? A lot of the chips used for IoT devices have historically not been the most advanced chips, right? These are not the high-end Intel processors, high compute things. Sometimes they're even made in like older, like 200 millimeter fabs, like ancient fabs, basically. But what has happened is as chips get more deeply integrated, as we do more with sensors and such, we're moving production to some of these more advanced fabs. So maybe not the TSMCs, but you still need Wi-Fi chips, for example, have been a problem. And there's just no place for them. Other things that are an issue is the Pis. Raspberry Pis have been hard to get. So hopefully we'll see not just like the most advanced manufacturing capability get promulgated through this, but also either the chip facilities that were making the most advanced for their time then get repurposed for, they get retrofitted to make some of the more IoT-focused chips. That would be great. And this sort of thing is actually going to be, like, it takes years to build a chip plant. So we're looking at Intel's new plant is supposed to be in like 2025, I believe. Samsung's new factory, I think, is also in that time frame. So the shortages and the reduction in shortages that we're seeing now is kind of like more of a supply chain, kind of easing up of the supply chain and demand. But it's still actually happening. So this will help the IoT, bottom line, but
it's going to take a while.
And some of the easing that we've seen is more of an easing in demand and an understanding of where products are in the supply chain now that the pandemic is, it's not over, but it has settled into a, I guess,
equilibrium.
Yeah, we have a better sense. So let's move on to Mobile World Congress, because man, there is definitely chip news from there as well. So big news on the LPWAN front, that's low power wireless access networks, Unibiz, which purchased Sigfox, and Unibiz has been a LoRaWAN company for a while. They also have done some NB-IoT as well. They actually did a deal to bring in some LoRaWAN, and then they bought Sigfox, which was a proprietary low power wide area network. So they've been talking up since their Sigfox acquisition, this idea of a unified LPWAN platform, and they made some big moves to make that a reality. So they brought in LoRaWAN capabilities and the Things Industries, which run the Things Networks, which is tons of existing LoRaWAN devices, services, and connectivity platform. So now that's moved into the Unibiz software as well. So if you've been running a Things network somewhere in your facility, and you've also been running NB-IoT stuff, you could actually combine those things under Unibiz now. So that's exciting. And I'll write more about that this week in the newsletter. We've also got a bunch of news related to satellite. So Qualcomm, which talked about satellite at CES and announced it for one of their for Android phones, mostly Android phones. Yeah, Kevin?
Yeah, because Apple's doing their own thing.
Apple announced theirs the end of last year, bringing satellite service to iPhones for, so not calling or surfing, just messaging, and under kind of limited circumstances.
Yeah, if I recall correctly, Apple invested in GlobalSat.
Yes.
And the Qualcomm bits are going to be done through Iridium.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes sense. And yeah, they did mention this at CES, and it's kind of confusing because now they're talking about more support, more phones in the future,
yeah,
having satellite. Yeah, at CES, they had said this would start being rolled out with devices running the Snapdragon 8 Gen 2 mobile platform, which is their highest end flagship smartphone chip. So I think the Samsung Galaxy S22 line, and I think maybe one other brand, maybe OnePlus or Honor or somebody, but it's going to be coming to more phones and more chips.
Yes. So at Mobile World Congress, they said, hey, we're going to put in Honor, Motorola, Nothing, Oppo, Vivo, and Xiaomi are all working to develop smartphones with satellite communications with Snapdragon satellite.
And Nothing was actually correct, even though some people are like, Nothing? What?
Nothing.
Nothing. Nothing. Yes, that's Carl Pei's company. Did you just have the one phone, the Nothing one? That's correct.
They launched a new phone, but we don't care about phones here on this show. So Snapdragon Satellite is going to be available, and this is the other big thing, on all upcoming 5G modem RF systems and Snapdragon mobile platform tiers from the 8 series to the 4 series tier. So this is big because this also is going to include IoT and industrial IoT platforms, which Qualcomm does do.
And cars.
And cars. And Qualcomm really wants to make this, they're going to have emergency services providers, but you'll also be able to text friends. And I think this is going to be really exciting. And I'm sure for the IoT, they're going to bring it out for like device connected, like sensor data.
Right.
And also related to satellite news, Deutsche Telekom said they're going to integrate satellite services into their IoT platform. They're going to use a partnership through Intelsat and Skylo for their global IoT satellite network. The idea is you're going to have satellite as a fallback to your NB-IoT, 4G or 5G networks.
And from a IoT perspective, I got to believe this is not going to be something you put on battery-powered type things.
No, they're talking, well, actually, they're talking about,
I mean, like, you could as a fallback, but
yeah. They're planning the commercial offering for the second quarter of this year. So that's like super fast.
Soon.
They're calling this interface the IoT hub. That's going to let you combine your connectivity across their cellular networks and bring in the satellite. You're going to have to add a satellite terminal, which is kind of a gateway device that will receive the signals from space and then put them on either a cellular or Wi-Fi network, whatever you've got. And you're going to have satellite capability, and you'll have to have that gateway somewhere near where you're trying to monitor. So if it's a wind farm, you'll have normal sensors. You won't have your satellite sensors on the wind farm. You'll have it at a gateway device that is near the wind farm.
So it'll aggregate all the data and then shoot it up.
Yeah, which makes sense. That,
oh, yeah.
That's a normal thing. And Intelsat is going to be using, they're going to use Intelsat for broadband, and Skylo is going to be for the narrowband devices. So that's more the IoT stuff. And I think we've talked to Skylo on the show, but if not, we'll get them on here. The satellite, like I said, I think I said this, satellite's going to be big this year, y'all. We're going to just keep seeing it pop up again and again. Yay. All right. It'll even be actually part of those unified LPWANs, believe it or not. Even if, I don't think it's really low power, but you'll see satellite combined with NB-IoT or satellite combined with LoRaWAN. Those are both popular options that are coming up. Okay, so Qualcomm also said that they're going to be doing Wi-Fi 7, and they talked about the Evan news.
Bleh.
Yeah.
I said this right before the show. I said I find it confusing that all these companies talk about these next-generation technologies when we're still in the early spurts of adopting the last two, 6 and 6E.
Yeah, and the fact that there's two and they weren't released simultaneously, so there was kind of like a possibility of a double network upgrade. So what you need to know right now for Wi-Fi 7 is Qualcomm, MediaTek, they've all got Wi-Fi 7 forward compatible chips. Like, the spec isn't even standardized. From a smart home or industrial IoT perspective, 7 is really more about boosting the quality of the network itself in the mesh. It's very much designed to run as a mesh and give you maximum speeds across a mesh network and more capacity across that network. There is a reduction in latency. Again, these are not going to be awesome for your smart home because no one's buying Wi-Fi 7 chips to put in smart home devices. Few people are buying Wi-Fi 6 chips to put in smart home devices, although I will note our sponsor, Silicon Labs, on Thursday is having their webinar, their Tech Talk webinar is actually about Wi-Fi 6 in smart home devices. So there you go. It's coming, but it's not out yet. You're like, as a normal person, you're not going to see this. So I'm going to tell everybody who's thinking about the IoT, don't worry about Wi-Fi 7 just yet. Just focus on 6. And then the final thing from Qualcomm that I love is we've talked about, they announced at Mobile World Congress, kind of how they're planning on doing 5G Advanced. And 5G Advanced is just really the common name for Release 17 of the 3GPP spec that came out in the summer. And this is really big for industrial IoT. And the reason is because mostly because it gives you precise positioning. And we talked about that last week with Qualcomm's like Qualcomm Aware thing, and it gives you like a bigger bandwidth. But the other thing it gives you that Qualcomm talked about was high resolution sensing. And I don't know if this is actually part of the standard, but Qualcomm's prototyping millimeter wave sensing. So in their 28 gigahertz outdoor system, they can detect multiple objects interfering with the millimeter wave, right? Interfering with those wavelengths. And they're doing also sensing for automated guided vehicles. So basically, they're using RF sensing at millimeter wave scale, which is pretty cool, I think, because we talk a lot about RF sensing with like Wi-Fi. We talk about it. Well, we've actually talked about it millimeter wave too. But Qualcomm bringing this out as opposed to a specialty chip company means it's actually about to go mainstream and we could get like cheaper versions of it. So yay. Okay, that's enough Mobile World Congress news. There's a lot about 5G and private 5G networks, but we're not going to care about that. Instead, we're going to talk about crazy data about who should be responsible for cybersecurity in the home.
It depends on who you ask and where they live. This is a really interesting World Economic Forum report that was also bolstered by research from Cujo AI Labs, who says that home computer networks are affected by at least one cybersecurity threat each month. Well, 67% of homes are, which is, ouch, kind of high. Nothing that you wouldn't anticipate here in the first half of the report, where they talk about the distribution of threats by device type. Basically, anything with data and or a camera would be high on the list, such as traditional computers, IP cameras, phones, network-attached storage devices, etc. Not so much smart homey stuff other than the cameras. But more interesting towards the bottom is who should, in your opinion, be responsible for preventing cybercrime and cyber attacks in the smart home. And they had asked people in Germany, Italy, France, and the U.S. And interesting to me, in the U.S., we were much higher to say we should do it as individuals. Stacey was not surprised by that.
Your other options, just so you know, it's me as an individual, the software developers, device manufacturers, the police, or ISPs, or quote unquote, the government. I feel like we're a little crazy because in the US, it was 44% thought individuals should be responsible. In Europe, no one got higher than 17%. Like everybody else was like, no, normal people should not have to handle their own cybersecurity. ISPs, way up there. Everyone was like, yeah, your ISP should.
Well, they are the pipe. They are the gateway. So yeah, I can see that. But
I think it's device manufacturers. I'll break it down. This is Stacy's opinion. Device manufacturers have to consider this. To force them to consider this, I think governments have to enact laws because otherwise people will just buy what's cheap. So you have to have a minimum standard for security enacted by the government, which thank goodness we're finally getting and have in most parts of the world. And then device manufacturers can layer onto that more stuff. Now, they did ask who's responsible for preventing cybercrime and cyber attacks. I don't really think police are, but they should be willing to compute them in a way that they're not today.
Yeah, the whole ISP bit, aren't they the ones who said they don't want to be just dumb pipes? I mean, so don't be a dumb pipe.
If you're not a dumb pipe, then they can charge you for it. So then if they're charging you for a security service, one could argue it'd be like your water utility charging you an extra fee to filter your water as opposed to making it just a
blanket. Yeah.
That's just my thought. This is a great report. Y'all should check it out. Smaller news bits. Infineon has launched a new chip ahead of, I know we're talking about Mobile World Congress this week, but in 2 weeks, it is Embedded World. Dun, dun.
Oh.
So we'll have news from there. But the first of that appears to be this Infineon news about, it's a new NFC chip, and it does two things. One, it's super efficient. So it doesn't use a lot of battery power to communicate when it's asked to communicate, and it's designed for wearables. And two, it does wireless charging. So you can actually charge your device via NFC, which is, I mean, NFC does require your device to be like next to, like within an inch or so of where it needs to be. But this is actually kind of neat because I know that you have a Magic Apple Watch and it just charges if you put it on like a charging pad, Kevin. But like my Fitbit, which is my wearable, my Fitbit Charge, I have to, like, I still have that magnetic attach thing that I have to.
Yeah. Pogo pins. Yes.
Yeah. So hey, it would be really great if I just had a little charger that would be, thank you, universal, please. And I could just stick it on that little charging pad. Or if I had my smart rings on. I no longer wear a smart ring, but I used to. And again, same issue. And the idea here is, and Infineon's actually introduced they have another wireless charging chip that's for smart locks, but they have a partnership to charge the battery in the smart lock. The smart lock solution that Infineon showed off last year uses NFC as well. It's not designed for your door lock at your home. It's more for unlocking things when you access control systems. Mm-hmm. It's like, what is that called when you're at a company and you have a card and you can use your phone? That is kind of what it's designed for. But it's exciting. And I love this idea of sipping power, either charging a device, like instead of just by sticking it in a box or sticking it on a pad, as opposed to like plugging something in.
That's one of the barriers to adoption of some of these smart wearables, certain rings and wristbands and so on. People don't want to mess with this wired magnetic type charger. If you lose that, or plus you've got to manually connect it, you can't just drop your device on there. I know it sounds like a first world problem, but I know people who just don't want to deal with those kind of connections.
Yeah, it's totally a pain. And when you start integrating, this is a very highly integrated solution, which is how they're getting some of the power savings. You make it cheaper to put this sort of thing in any kind of device. And I don't know about you, Kevin, but I one day look forward to actually just having it integrated into my, like, a tracker into, like, my jewelry. So I could swap out, not my band, but just, like, straight up my bracelet for the day that's going to track my activity. Or maybe one day I'll wear a ring and another day I also need interoperability on the software side, which I know isn't really happening, but let me dream.
So you want multiple devices. I just want one chip in my body and I'm done.
Oh, well, there's that too. Speaking of wireless power, ASSIA, which is a wireless power company, it's actually in my backyard here in Washington State, they're in Redmond. They have a partnership with Arcos, which is a French company. They announced this not at CES this year, but CES last year, that they were going to do wireless smart home devices. Arcos makes security cameras, air purifiers, all kinds of random stuff. And it's finally out. I know it's a little late, but not super late. Arcos is announcing the Coda Wireless Power Security Cameras. And this is going to be a security camera. It has a battery. It says without the need for batteries. What they're saying is you don't have to recharge or change the batteries, but it doesn't have any wires. You're not going to have to charge it. ASSIA is going to power this over the air. And you're going to have the ASSIA bridge, the Coda bridge. ASSIA's power transfer technology is called Coda. You'll have that bridge sending out power to your camera, and your camera has a chip inside that will receive it, and boom, it's done.
Yeah, they're going to have it in two bundles for sale. Well, the pre-orders, I guess it says they are offering two for pre-order, so my guess is you can get them now. You can make the order now. First one's for commercial spaces, it says. Mm-hmm. Interesting. That are 600 to 800 square feet. You get one Coda transmitter and three cameras, and the other bundle is for larger spaces, 800 to 1200 square feet.
Yes.
Which gets you two wireless
power transmitters and six cameras. The cameras need to be within 30 feet cameras, of the transmitter. And I love this because, like, I will tell you, the first time I had my Arlo wireless security cameras, I like climbed up a tree and stuck it in there. Uh-huh. And I did not think about changing. First low battery notice, I was like, ah, crap on a cracker.
I've been up the ladder every 7 or 8 months for one of my outdoor wireless cameras as well, just so I can plug it into a USB cord and charge it and then go back up the ladder and stick it back up there.
Yeah. So this ends that, but it does need to still be within 30 feet. So maybe you want to
see. Last time the ladder hit me on the head, so that's good.
Yeah, I didn't love that. All right.
I know.
ADT reported earnings, and you guys are like, well, I don't care, Stacey. But you do care, because ADT has this deal with Google where they resell Google stuff and Google Nest gear, I should say. And as part of their earnings, they talked about adoption. And during 2022, the attachment rate for the Nest doorbell was approximately 50%. That's 50. And the Nest cameras are currently realizing a 30% increase in cameras per home. And that, in turn, for ADT, drove a 26% increase in residential installation revenue per unit. That's crazy. That's great for them. So this deal is going really well for them. It's probably good for Google because they can sell more doorbells and whatnot. So I just thought that was worth noting. And I will also say I was surprised by this because people apparently like it because ADT is seeing lower attrition in their customers. So fewer customers are like getting rid of the service and their revenue payback. So if you sign a deal with ADT and you do the monthly contracts with them, all the hardware they give you, it takes 2.1 years to pay that off, basically, which is pretty mm-hmm. good. That means they just need to keep you for 2.5 years and they've made money on you. Yay. Mm-hmm. So that's it. I just thought that was really interesting. They also said they're going to start launching offers to people who are State Farm policyholders in the second quarter of this year. So I'm looking forward to that because last year, ADT, they received a $1.2 billion investment from State Farm. And they were like, oh, we're going to change the way we think about smart homes and insurance. So we're going to start to see that actually happen in the second quarter of this year, which is not now, but soon, in a couple months.
Couple weeks.
Okay. And finally, we talked about wearables and how much I love my Fitbit. Is just going in the crapper right now. Good Lord. If you have one, you're like...
And why is that? Why? Who bought Fitbit again?
Google bought Fitbit. And yeah. I was a little nervous about this deal. And it turns out...
You were
out
not
was,
happy. You were
I was
not
right.
happy. But hey, you could get a Google Pixel Watch instead. And I know it's not as good as your Fitbit, but now they have fall detection, which they just added. They
yeah.
announced that this week. Yeah.
They so. Did. And Apple's had this on their watch. And it's actually been a reason I'm sad that I'm not able to get an Apple Watch because I refuse to buy into the Apple phone system. Refuse is a strong word. Kevin really likes his, and somebody's got to be on Android. And I just hate the closed ecosystem. I'll be honest. Anyway, I've wanted fall detection forever because I actually faint a lot. Not a lot, but I do faint.
Enough that this would help you.
Yes, enough that people around me are like, you should really go for Apple Watches.
Yeah.
So this is great. But I was hoping more that I would get, instead of having a Pixel Watch, I would get this on like my Fitbit watch. I have found Fitbit's hardware and software in Google's hardware and Wear OS.
I wouldn't disagree with you, but I don't think Google's going to push features to Fitbit. I think it's all the other way around, pull the Fitbit features into Google.
But they're not even pulling the features. So they've started killing Fitbit features that people love, like the community challenges and badges they pulled.
Yep.
And I'm sad about that because
well, that's a social thing, and Google's terrible
I know,
at social.
But, like, you could have said Fitbit's good at it, and that's why we're acquiring them, but
I know.
They didn't.
I know.
So, yeah. I imagine in the next year, I'm going to be looking seriously at a new fitness tracker and activity tracker and be like,
bleh.
I'm going to be sad.
I have to check the fall detection on the Apple Watch because I'm a little surprised that Google's implementation says if you take a hard fall and the watch detects that you aren't moving for about 30 seconds, it vibrates. And then it will go on and start making noises and you can tap, you're okay, or you can be connected to emergency services, etc. But 30 seconds, I don't think the Apple Watch has got a 30-second delay on that.
Well, 30 seconds isn't terrible. Because I know when
if you
I fall,
your head open, it is. Yeah.
It takes you, like, I mean, I fall downstairs too, not just faint. But whenever I fall, there is that minute of you're like, whew, what just happened? Did I break anything? And then you're like, okay. And at that point, I'm capable of tapping even if I'm not capable of getting up. And it's probably to help with all the people who are skiing. You know how the Apple yeah. Watch has been like, oh, look, these people are skiing. No, they're falling. Call 911.
Well, apparently using their magic AI and so on, they have tested the feature against high energy activities that involve impact, sudden drop, or excessive arm movements. So maybe they can handle those false notifications, which is great because I know a lot of people are having problems with their Apple phones and crash detection, for example. I just was surprised to see that 30 seconds. Maybe it's the way it is on iPhone too. I'll have to fall and see. I don't know.
Go for it. Get that ladder out again, Kevin. Okay, now it's time for the Internet of Things podcast hotline, the segment of the show where we hear from you and hopefully answer your questions. The hotline is sponsored by Very, an end-to-end IoT engineering and design firm. You should partner with Very to work through complexity and deliver business value rapidly. Learn more at verytechnology.com. Same sponsor, different URL, you guys, so note that. All right. It's a new month, and we have a winner for the month of February who is going to win a smart Things Station. Our winner is Thomas, and we actually answered your question about 3 weeks ago. Kevin, what was his question?
He was looking for a whole house electronic monitoring system.
Oh, yeah, that was a great question, Thomas. So yes. Congratulations, you are a winner of a Samsung SmartThings station, and we'll reach out to you about that. And this week's voicemail is from Brian, and he has a question about helping his mother know when he's calling. Let's hear it.
Hey, Stacy. This is Brian Brown, Columbus, Ohio. I've been listening for a while. Enjoy your show. I got my mother into being an early adopter of Amazon when she was living in her own home. And that worked very well with turning off lights that she couldn't reach, and she could just say, turn off lights. Now she's in an assisted living. Her hearing is bad. She doesn't answer her iPhone. She doesn't look at text or messages, but she does stare at the TV. So I was wondering, is there a device that I could text to a box that would be connected to her TV that would display a message on the TV while it was broadcasting her favorite news program? I know there's some other technologies that have done similar things in the past, but I don't see anything that's commercially available to the consumer. If you happen to know of something, I would appreciate it. Thanks a lot. Have a great day.
So there's a couple things that could be done here, but I don't think any of them are going to be exactly what Brian is looking for. I don't know of a box that you could put, connect to your TV and have it flash a message that says, hey, pick up your phone, mom, I'm calling you. But we sort of thought, well, what could we reuse or repurpose to make this happen in a different way? And since Brian's mom enjoyed the Madam A and the Echo devices before she went into assisted living, we were thinking that an inexpensive Echo Dot and perhaps a smart bulb, could be a Bluetooth bulb, in fact, so she doesn't have to rely on the Wi-Fi for two devices there, because that's managed Wi-Fi in an assisted living home, could be the best option where Brian could flash the light.
Or he could drop in and just shout at her.
That too. And in fact, with the drop-in, on certain Echoes, you have a little light that kind of spins around or whatever flashes.
Yeah, to say, I think it's a green light.
Yeah, we tested that, you and I did, a couple years back. I do remember that. And would she see that little ring of light? I don't know. Like, it would have to be near the TV.
If you stuck it up by the TV, maybe?
Maybe. But if you had a smart bulb going on, going off, et cetera, by the TV, that I'm sure she would see, I would hope.
Yeah, or just anywhere in the room, because usually it's usually like a studio or a one room kind of thing. And most of them have Wi-Fi. So I actually just this weekend was helping someone out with in an assisted living space connect some devices. So we wanted to keep it simple and keep only one device connected to the Wi-Fi. And if you're feeling flush, you could actually subscribe to Amazon's, is it Care Together, Kevin?
I believe it is, yes. It's $20 a month.
It is $20 a month, but it's a program that lets someone who's control someone else Echo device.
Or even see if like their devices are on, like mom is supposed to be up at night, but yet her lights aren't on, her TV's not on, et cetera. You know, you could go that route.
So really the big question is, can your mom install something on the facility's Wi-Fi network? Usually that is totally doable and hopefully it will stay on. My Echoes don't fall off the Wi-Fi network. If it was a Google device, I'd be like, don't use Google. Because my Google devices do fall off the Wi-Fi network sometimes. It's very irritating. Mm-hmm. But I've never had devices fall off. So that's my recommendation.
Yeah. And trying to keep it to a non-Wi-Fi bulb.
Just one less device.
And so it'd be a local control kind of thing for the Echo with a Bluetooth bulb or even a Zigbee bulb. But so we looked at Philips Hue because you can just do Bluetooth without the Zigbee Hue hub. You're going to spend $15 to $20 for if you want like a, just a plain old white Philips Hue bulb with those radios. If you want to go color, which may make sense because maybe she'd see red or blue or green or something.
Depending on who's calling.
Yeah, but at least on Amazon right now, they're $50 a bulb. So, I mean, it's still cheaper than the $20 a month over time as well. So it's going to come down to cost and access to the Wi-Fi network, being able to put an Echo device on there.
Yes. And I will also say, if you decide to do like the Echo fourth generation, it's the $99 bigger one. It's not the Echo Dots. That has Zigbee in it. But I'm going to caution you that if you decide to go with a Zigbee setup, there are very few bulbs that will work with the Amazon Echo that don't require an additional Zigbee hub. So be careful when you're doing this to look for if you're going to go the Zigbee route. The Philips Hue bulb will work, and we'll include a link to the type of bulb. It's both the Bluetooth and the Zigbee one. It's not just the Zigbee one, because then you're going to need another hub. And then that's another Wi-Fi device on the network. And at that point, just buy a Wi-Fi bulb. Okay, so hopefully this is an idea that will help you. Plus, your mom then gets the ability to turn her lights on if she's got a reading lamp. This is actually how we communicate with my kid. We flash the lights to get them to come upstairs. So for what it's worth, it's a handy dandy way of communicating. All right. If you would like to give us a call for March, we will not only possibly enter your question, but we will also enter you to win a, we've got to come up with a new device. We'll tell you next week what you'll win. Let's do that. Where I'm never prepared. I'm never thinking ahead enough. But you can call us at 512-623-7424, and you'll be entered to win. And now, stay tuned for our guest, Paulus Schautzen, who is the co-founder of Home Assistant. And he is going to talk to us all about what's coming next for Home Assistant, why you can't buy the Home Assistant yellow, what he thinks of Matter, and so much more. Oh, and we're doing a ChatGPT demo. So I should also warn everybody, as part of that demo, we shout out to Apple's digital assistant and Google's digital assistant. So be prepared and maybe turn everything off. Okay, stay tuned for that. But first, a message from our sponsor. This week's sponsor is Influx Data. Hey, everyone. We are taking a quick break from the Internet of Things podcast for a message from our sponsor. This week's sponsor is InfluxDB, and I have Brian Mullen, the Chief Marketing Officer at InfluxDB, here to talk to us about the database and some of its customers. Today's customer is Magic. Brian, what is InfluxDB?
InfluxDB is a platform for developers to handle time series data at scale. To give you an idea what time series data is, it's really just data that is stamped in time in some way. And that could be hours or minutes or seconds or even nanoseconds. Handling this type of data is pretty difficult and time consuming, and InfluxDB makes it simple and fast. And so developers can ingest, store, and analyze all types of time series data. And that covers metrics, events, and traces. And they can do it all in a platform that is designed to handle the high speed and high volume data ingest and real-time analysis. And InfluxDB itself consists of our core database and storage engine, the API, and a surrounding ecosystem of tools and integrations to ingest, query, and analyze that time series data.
Sweet. So why does a purposely built time series platform matter to IoT folks?
Today, pretty much all IoT data is time series data. It's generated by sensors, systems, and applications that change over time and are, you know, therefore timestamped in some way. And so as companies build new IoT systems and applications, the developers themselves working on those just have to keep up with the data, which is growing exponentially. The sources of data in IoT are everywhere. I mean, it could be sensors on a wind turbine, solar panels on a roof, temperature gauges in smart agriculture field, or even sensors and gauges in a connected car, like the ones we drive every day. And these sources are producing data, things like temperature and usage and battery life, location, speed, engine efficiency. Now multiply all of that by the time intervals, and that's a lot of data.
What are some of the challenges associated with this amount of data?
First is, you know, pure volume. It's a massive workload of data, exponentially larger than is typical. And second, for a typical database, whether it's relational or document, you know, laboring through so many of these reads and writes really impacts performance. The ingest is slow and the query is even slower. The long-term retention and access becomes really difficult. So if you have tons of very recent or hot data alongside a longer history of older, important, but slightly less relevant cold data, how do you manage both? These are the hard technical challenges that most incumbent DBs are just not able to handle. And so where other DBs and tools fade, InfluxDB really shines. Solving these time series challenges is why InfluxDB exists.
So can you tell me a little bit about how your customers are using InfluxDB?
Yes. So let's look at an example. Magic makes monitoring software for the manufacturing and processing space. Their product improves what's known as OEE, or overall equipment effectiveness within their factories that are running that software. And they use InfluxDB to collect, store, and analyze data that is actually coming from the factory floor in those deployments, providing insights into the operation of the machines and units that are running on that floor.
All right. And where can our listeners go to find out more about InfluxDB?
The best thing to do is to try the product. And you can do that by going to our website at influxdata.com.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Internet of Things podcast. This is your host, Stacey Higginbotham, and today's guest is Paulus Schautzen, who is the founder of Home Assistant. Hello, Paulus. How are you today?
Hey, Stacey. How are you?
I am excellent, and I'm really excited to talk to you again. We had you on the show about 18 months ago or a little longer than that. And for those who don't know, Home Assistant is a DIY smart home platform. You can do so much. And Paulus is going to actually show us some cool things they've been working on. But first, I think we should probably get started. Y'all have this ongoing effort. This is the year of voice for Home Assistant.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Yeah, correct. So, you know, we actually kind of each year with Home Assistant, we set ourselves a goal to try to like, what is our main focus, right? We have a Home Assistant built around volunteers. Last year, we were the second most active open source project on GitHub. We had like 13,200 people contribute to Home Assistant. And it's always good to kind of have a theme so that all the people that want to get involved, they kind of have a direction. Because if you just let all these volunteers just be like, hey, just suggest whatever you want to improve, that's going to go everywhere. And so we used to have like streamlining experiences. We had like making it easier, and you know, which was part of the struggle where we came from. It was too difficult. We've been making it easier for the last couple of years. And we kind of got to a point where we're like, we do a few things very well. Dashboards, great. Automations, the most powerful automation engine. Customizations, all that stuff works great. But the one thing that's kind of lacking, especially with our focus on local control and privacy, is voice. Now, you can use Home Assistant with Google and with Amazon, but it all goes through the cloud. And it also means that you have to share all your home data with these companies. And there's just people that don't want that, or they want to do everything local. And so we really need to find a way to do this on our own without relying on other parties. And we thought, let's just make it our focus. You know, when you look in the open source world, there's always a lot of work going on around like voice assistants. But what you see is that actually a lot of projects, they always evolve around English. And the reason for that is because with English, well, it's the common language on the internet, or at least on our part of the internet, right? In China, there's a different language, but it means that you can find the most people to collaborate with. However, with Home Assistant, it's something you run at home. It's the most personal space of your life, and it needs to be in your language, right? You shouldn't have to adapt to technology. Technology should adapt to you. So we set ourselves the goal 2023 is to allow Home Assistant users to control their home in their own language. And we don't want to do this in a way where we, you know, we don't want to build a full-on voice assistant with Wikipedia and these kind of things. We really want to just focus on controlling like the things in your house, the lights, the switches, the curtains, asking if the garage door is open, these kind of things.
That's awesome. And we speak two languages in our house, so I'm all about that. How are y'all doing this?
Right. So when you think of a voice assistant, and super simplified high level, there's actually three parts of it. The first part is like hot word detection and recording the audio stream. So you want to know what the user said and have this as an audio stream. The second part is turning this audio stream into natural language, so into like actual text, so speech to text. And the third part is actually processing the natural language into a command that, you know, Home Assistant can understand and can translate to its existing control of devices. And what we're doing, our first step right now, is to actually start at the end. So we are really focusing on processing natural language, and we focus not on just English, we do all the languages. So we've built a system and a framework that our contributors and the community can like work on together to build out support for as many languages as we have people using Home Assistant. So we did a kind of a roundup presentation a few weeks ago called Year of the Voice Chapter 1. And in that announcement, we already had 22 different languages that were supported. And the community has been continuing to adding some more language supported and expanding also the existing languages with more sentences. Of course, you know, having just a text input is kind of boring. So we've been playing with like having Siri talk to the Home Assistant, have like Android watches talk to Home Assistant. And so we've been like doing different things, but as long as the speech to text and stuff happens outside of Home Assistant, It kind of works good, okay, right now. And this is just very much still the beginning. So don't think you can like, this is going to replace everything. But, you know, there's something and this is enough to get more attention and more people working on it.
Okay. Do you want to show us Google working? And by show, I mean have us listen to Google working through Siri. I should warn people, this is a good time to turn off any voice assistants that might get activated by shouting for Madam S.
Right. So what we did is that we've actually, you know, in Home Assistant, of course, we can use our natural language processing engine, but you can also outsource it to third-party systems. So we have support for Google. We have support for OpenAI, which is pretty known for ChatGPT nowadays, although that one is not accessible through an API. So we use GPT-3 or like a lesser variant. But yeah, one of the things we can do is that we can actually talk to Google. So I'll give a quick demo now by actually talking to a HomePod. So I'm going to say the hot word for the Apple device. So keep an eye out to like cancel it out maybe if you're listening in the car. Hey Siri, hey Google.
Google here, what's up?
Who made you?
I was made by a team of people at Google.
So that was what was happening here is that I activated a shortcut on Siri that would record my voice and translate it to text. The text was being sent to Home Assistant, which then sent it to Google, which generated the answer, which then Home Assistant sent back to Siri. Siri did the text-to-speech. And so that's how we have a basic voice assistant. It's cumbersome. It's like, you know, you need to have a two-way step process to talk to the HomePod. But it's, you know, it's a start.
And it's a way, if you've got some stuff that you have only working on your Google Home, you could kind of bridge this over. We get a lot of people who are trying to do very specific things. And if you're doing, I always tell people, if you're doing something incredibly specific and you might need your own sensors or tying a bunch of stuff together, Home Assistant is really a good way to go, although it is complicated. Before we leave on the year of the voice, and we'll get back to ChatGPT and some of the things you're doing to make things easier, you also hired someone or acquired, I don't know, with open source, I never know how to describe this. You've enticed someone to come work with you on something. Well, who is that and what is that?
Yeah, so we didn't acquire, but we hired the lead developer of Raspi or the founder of Raspi, Mike Hansen. The reason Raspi has been very interesting to us is because it actually has kind of a shared idea, just like we have, and it wants to support all the languages. So Mike has been working with his community on building speech-to-text models and text-to-speech models in a lot of different languages, not just English. So he has a lot of expensive video cards at home and he helps like train these models. It's he works either like, you know, he has his community contribute voices so that they, you know, they can use to train models. He also uses, there's a huge collection of people reading the Bible online, which is great because you need audio mapped to the text that's being read for like the speech to text. So the Bible is actually used for a lot of these open source speech to text models. And he's been working on this with his community to try to like, you know, build out a toolkit for people to build their own. But it was always a bit too difficult. Like it required still a lot of steps to set up and it really needed some more full-time effort and to also get some more focus on like making it easy to use. And so, yeah, Mike joined Nabucasa. Nabucasa is the commercial arm of Home Assistant. And he's been working full time now on making voice a part of Home Assistant. And he does that with his experience from Raspi. We are not fully integrating Raspi. Like we're just taking the best parts. And we will, of course, also like some of the stuff will come back into Raspi as well. So hopefully in the end, a lot about the assistant and voice stuff in the open source world is about having these models, creating these models and making it accessible to as many people as possible. And that's just something where we can greatly contribute with our community.
Now, as part of making that easier, and this might segue into that conversation, are you going to do your own hardware here with voice?
So that is the plan, yes. So we obviously started out very small now with like leveraging like things like a HomePod, but our ultimate goal is you shouldn't have to rely on a third-party company to do voice in your home for control. So we are looking into different chips, and you know we have some experience now with building hardware with our Home Assistant Yellow Hub and our Sky Connect sticks. And so we are hoping that, yeah, I don't know, we don't really have a timeline yet because, you know, once everything kind of clicks together in a prototype, then we can move on like the next phase of production and chip sourcing and all that stuff. But our goal is to make an open voice assistant where it still would outsource a lot of the processing to like a server, being Home Assistant or any other project or company, we wouldn't lock it down, but it would just do a local device that can do hardware detection and record the audio.
Got it. And this is probably more important than ever because like Mycroft at the end of January shut down, and that was kind of a loss for the open source voice community. Let's talk about Home Assistant Yellow. So we tested out the first one, which was Home Assistant Blue, and that was just the brains on hardware because for a lot of people, it's a pain to be like, I've got to go buy a Pi and download and upload and put an SD card in. It was a lot, but that didn't have radios. Is Yellow actually out yet? What's the status on Yellow? And tell us what Yellow is.
So Home Assistant Yellow is like our take on what a home automation hub should be. So where, you know, you said about the blue, it didn't have the radio. So with the yellow, we wanted to do everything right. Like if we were to buy ourselves a home automation hub for our home, what do we want? So we wanted it to be kind of upgradable, kind of be able to grow with you. So with the Home Assistant Yellow, it's built around the Raspberry Pi Compute Module 4. So this is not a normal Raspberry Pi. It's like only the brains of a Raspberry Pi that you can plug into a board. The nice thing is that it means that if you want to have more memory in your Home Assistant Yellow, you can actually replace your CM4 with a one with more memory. We also added a place that you can add like a hard drive to it. And of course, it comes with a radio. The radio is a Zigbee/Thread radio. So those they use the same frequency. And we're currently having experimental support to actually run both Zigbee and Thread in parallel, which means that users can use both Zigbee and then Thread is used mainly for Matter, but you could also run HomeKit over it.
And I can buy that now?
Maybe. No, so the story is that we did a crowdfunding on this 1.5 years ago, and we've been, the biggest challenge we had was actually in, there's two challenges we had. One was getting Compute Module 4s, and so we sell a variant that has the Compute Module 4 already pre-installed with Home Assistant and works out of the box. We also have a kit version where you bring your own Compute Module 4, which means that if you want to go bigger than the Compute Module 4 that we built into the normal one, you can already, you don't have to waste the Compute Module 4. Now, the kit variant with Power over Ethernet, we had some design issues on getting like all the electricity flowing correctly, but all of these should have been shipped last month. So in January, all the people that had done the original backing and the pre-orders, they have all shipped. Now, we have been making more, and they will arrive hopefully next month, and we actually have a second place where you can buy them now. So there is some availability. However, because there has not been much availability until now, it tends to be that when things come available, they sell out right away. With the Raspberry Pi, I mean, they are really in a crunch. So it looks like the second half of this year, there will be more Raspberry Pis, but basically once every 2 months or something, we get like a box of like, hey, here's 250 Compute Module 4s. And it's like, it's not enough, right? Like 250 devices and then to basically do a whole production run, send it over to like a distributor, it gets too small. So then sometimes we sit longer on it or whatever. And yeah, so right now we don't have any Compute Modules. So the basic yellow that we want people to buy to get started easily with Home Assistant is not really available. But this summer will be better. That's the main thing.
We'll hope some pies fall off the back of a truck somewhere and they make it to you. No, we should not be stealing pies, y'all. Okay, let's talk about Matter. Y'all are going to support Matter?
So CSA Alliance is where Zigbee development happens and where Matter development happens. And so we joined that alliance last March or April or something. So we are like a participating member. So you have like different levels of membership. And so we had to pay like the higher level because we want to be involved, like be part of the Slack group and be able to talk with the people that are actively working on it and contribute ourselves. And so we've been involved. We haven't really like done a lot of development. We mainly do bug fixes and these kind of things and been testing it out since the last summer. And then like last November, the first, you know, Matter 1.0 got released, which it was kind of an event, you know, a lot of people had expectations, but it's like, no, the spec is standardized and Google, Apple, and then also we Home Assistant, we had like a working version, but there's no devices. And even the working version wasn't really fully working, had some quirks and bugs. And all in all, I think that like, you know, I think next year will definitely be better. Yeah, so we published a big update on Matter in the beginning of February about like, where do we stand? What are we up to? And all the features that we currently support, which was great because we posted videos about how you can share a device that's currently working with your Apple or Google Meta network from their apps into Home Assistant without like having to go through like a full pairing ritual, but you do like this side pairing where you share it from Google to Home Assistant. And we have like, they've actually built all the support into iOS and Android. So our Home Assistant apps on those platforms can work smoothly with all that stuff. So Android is very nice where you can, when you hit share on a Meta device, you get this just a share tab as normal. And then Home Assistant is just an option. And boom, your device is in Home Assistant. In Home Assistant itself, we're doing a lot of work just to control Meta devices. We get a lot of requests from people if we can be controlled over Meta, because that's kind of the dream that people have when they don't want to use Home Assistant, but they, for example, are really like into Apple or Google, and they want to have Apple or Google talk through Home Assistant to all those devices that are not going to have Meta. But that implementing Meta is just so much work, so that's not been a goal right now for us. It's for us to really be the controller and control stuff. And of course, we, you know, you can share your devices to Google and Apple. The beauty is that for Meta devices, you know, you can pair to 5 controllers or fabrics, as it's Meta speak. And so that will work great.
Okay. And earlier you said Meta will be a big deal next year. Since we're still at the beginning of 2023, I just want to think, are you saying in 2024 you think it's going to matter?
We're already seeing some devices like pop up, right? The TP-Link Meta device was being sold like on Amazon as a Meta device. You know, and I bought it and I opened the box, I plugged it in, I got a pop-up on an Android phone. I said, set it up with Home Assistant, scan the QR code, and it was in Home Assistant, no TP-Link app necessary. It works. It's actually like, it is delivering on that part of the like the promise. And I expect that there's currently just a big backlog of people that want to get certified or the firmware doesn't work. There's, of course, chips and whatever people are working on. So I expect more and more devices to support Meta later this year. I don't have a lot of faith in vendors that say, oh, we're going to update all devices, because there's just Meta requires a lot of extra CPU power, like because of the 5 fabrics and stuff. So all devices are probably not going to be supported. You probably see, I think Xiaomi and Philips and IKEA, they are just saying our hub are going to be the Meta.
There'll be bridges.
The bridges, yeah. And internally, they're still going to use Zigbee, which is like, nah, it's not really Meta for me, right? Like it has to be Thread and it has to be Wi-Fi based, and that will like be really nice. But if we look at Philips Hue, it will be always better for us to just talk the Philips Hue API to the Philips Hue bridge than to talk Meta.
Right. Okay. And now let's have some fun. Generative AI is everywhere. ChatGPT is the latest example. Even images like DALL-E and Stable Diffusion, all exciting. And we've seen a couple companies use ChatGPT, for example, which is a language model to tie into a smart home. And, you know, it's kind of silly. It's fun. I don't think this is going to change the world today. But what are y'all doing on that front? It may not be ChatGPT.
Well, so the first thing is that we actually banned ChatGPT from our forums. So we actually saw that a lot of people, they thought that, wow, with ChatGPT, you can get all these answers. And without them having the actual knowledge, they were starting to help people on our forums with questions they had about Home Assistant. However, the downside with these generative models is that they're wrong, right? They're outdated. They use whatever models they see. And you know, a lot of people share their configuration on GitHub, and it's trained a lot of times on GitHub data as well, but that uses custom components and plugins that don't exist, or it starts making up things because it sees a pattern in our configuration, but there's definitely no pattern because this is just, you know, mashed together over years. And so we just saw that a lot of people were getting advice that was wrong, but it was very convincingly written. And what started to happen is that people got frustrated because you see an answer and it looks very correct. It has like good formulated sentences, indentation, different steps to take. And then people don't succeed and they think it's their issue, because why else would somebody write so much time and effort into writing such a beautiful explanation? And so we saw this again and again and again. And our moderators started to spot, like it was very clear when ChatGPT was being used. And so at some point we were like, we're just like whacking mole, like deleting all these posts. And we're like, no, we're just going to straight up ban it. So for supporting people, like, don't do it, because you need to be an expert to see that the generated answer, like where to fix it. But if you are such an expert, then you wouldn't need AI to generate that answer to begin with. But we do like generative AI models, and we actually do have in our last release, we introduced the OpenAI integration. And it means that if you want to use like our natural language processing, like for example, the HomePod, you can actually talk to OpenAI. OpenAI is of course known for ChatGPT, but they also have some smaller models which you can actually access through an API. So we did that. And so you can now, for example, use your HomePod to talk to OpenAI. However, it's not useful, right? It's more fun. And I use it a lot to like entertain my children. And the reason for this is that it doesn't know anything about your home. And it also, we don't have it generate like commands that are being executed by Home Assistant. So it's really just a conversation between the speaker and a chat model.
Yeah, you mentioned you were using it to tell your kids stories at some point in time. And so you set this up. So do you want to explain what we're doing here or show us what we're doing and then explain it?
Yeah, so my kids are really into Mario right now, especially Bowser. And he wants to hear stories about like, you know, I want to hear like Bowser fight Sonic, or what about Bowser versus like Minecraft or something. And so then he asks me like, oh, can you tell me a story about that? And then I will ask it to OpenAI, and then they give me an answer. So I can give you a demo. So I set up like a special, I think previously when I was talking to my HomePod, I triggered the Google word to kind of like go into like a Google mode. This one is a special mode that it is a bit longer to respond, but it's more because it's like to entertain the kids, right? That's the goal. Hey Siri, let's do magic.
Magic mirror on the wall. What is your question for us all?
Can you tell me a story between a fight between Bowser and Minecraft?
Well, Bowser and Minecraft were fighting one day over who was the better video game character. Bowser was really angry, and he started to fire fireballs at Minecraft. Minecraft used his blocks to create a wall to protect himself, but the fireballs kept hitting the wall. Bowser got angry and started to
stop.
Oh man, we're going to need some copyright protection on that. Excellent. And how did you set that up via Home Assistant?
So actually, it's very easy. So we just have the OpenAI integration, which you can configure through the user interface. So if you're in the documentation, there's just a button, add to Home Assistant. Or if you're inside Home Assistant, you go to the config panel, device and services, and there's like a add integration button. And all you need from OpenAI itself is a API key. So obviously, this will cost money. This, I think the request I just did probably is like half a cent or something. So it's not like it's going to break the bank, but you do have to put in your credit card to get an API key. And then you can also, in the next version of Home Assistant, so the one that's coming out in March, we actually allow you to customize the prompt, which means that the prompt is how you configure the AI model to kind of be in your theme or style. So you could have it, for example, say, hey, talk like a pirate or these kind of things.
Talk like a pirate would still be a big hit in my house. Well, thanks for giving us your half cent worth of demo there. I appreciate it. And Paulus, thanks for coming on the show this week.
Yeah, awesome.
And that concludes this week's episode of the Internet of Things podcast. Please join us next Thursday, and don't forget to subscribe. And if you can't get enough IoT news, I would love for you to sign up at www.stacyonIoT.com for our weekly IoT newsletter, where we explain all kinds of things that we don't even get to on the show. Once again, thank you for listening, and please subscribe.